ominous movie music. She smiled, laughed, and scooped up the cards. But as she did, I saw that her hands were shaking slightly. We sat in silence as the Acela train blasted like a switch across the miserable ass of Delaware. Gazing out at the blur of tract housing and strip malls, for some reason, I started thinking about the book The Little Red Caboose, which my mom used to read to me when I was a kid. How wonderful the illustrations had made the world seem. Shiny cars and friendly policemen as the train went through the city, apple-cheeked farmers driving corn-filled pickups in the country, painted Indians on horseback as the train chugged up the mountain. I remembered looking at the pictures for hours, at the world that was waiting for me, happy, colorful, safe. As we went into a tunnel, I closed my eyes and saw the card again. The Judgment. What kind of storybooks would I be reading to my children? I wondered. Chapter 45. It was about 9 at night when we emerged from Penn Station onto the bustling expanse of 8th Avenue in Midtown Manhattan. The dark mood that had gripped me after the tarot reading hadn't let go. The city was wet. The clouds had broken into rain during our journey, and now the weather alternated between drizzle and bursts of harder rain. We stood on the curb, burdened with our luggage, without umbrellas, getting wet. Steam rose from the streets, and the headlights of the cars were mirrored in the shimmering asphalt. We flagged down a cab. I opened the door for Chloe and dumped our bags in the trunk. I got in and told the driver my address. On the seat beside me, Chloe was gaping through the window at the looming Empire State Building. It was lit up in tiers of white and blue.
"I have not been in New York City in a long time," she said.
The rain gathered new momentum and drummed on the roof of the car like flung handfuls of gravel. Chloe was quiet. She snuggled into the crook of my arm, and I listened to the rhythmic rubber-on-glass squeals of the windshield wipers. The city lights blasted past us, twinkling like hazy underwater jewels in the dark.
"It's leaving, isn't it?"
she said quietly into my chest. "What's leaving? What are you talking about?" She sat up a little. Her eyes were moist.
"I'm afraid that Claire Dugard is right," she said. "The world is ending. Everything that everyone has worked so hard for, our parents, their parents, it's all going away. And no one is going to do anything about it. And it's just so sad."
"You can't think like that," I said, softly squeezing her shoulders. "This is crazy, I know, but we can solve it. We're going to figure it out."
"I don't know what to think anymore. We dreamed the same dream. That's impossible. And then, seeing that tarot card on the train, it's silly, I know, but it scared me to death. I feel strange. I feel very strange."
I didn't know what to say, so I just held her as she dissolved into real, racking sobs. We'd been through a lot lately. I hoped it was the jet lag. I thought what the grandmotherly Alice Boyd had said about the eerie, seemingly precognitive animal behavior right before natural disasters. I thought about the elephants and the birds heading for the hills days before the tsunami. What was the term Alice had used? A cosmic event? After a moment, I looked down at Chloe, and she reached for my face, a hand on each cheek, and kissed me deeply. Her face melted into mine. She kissed me, and I kissed back. I kissed back. Chapter 46. Yellow. A yellow car stops downstairs, in front of the building. Attila arrives at a thumping run at the front window of the apartment, gazes down at the street below. He looses a wild, piercing shriek as the cab door opens and he sees Oz. He hops up and down, howling in excitement. He stops and is quiet. His dark, glistening brown eyes glide downward and see something else. Oz is reaching into the cab. Now another person emerges from the yellow thing. Even from 5 floors up, Attila can see it is a female, a woman. Attila's face drops. He begins to whimper. The black tips of his long, leathery fingers press against the glass. He blows from his nostrils in soft, sorrowful puffs as he stares down at his friend and the newcomer. His sadness sours into a feeling of betrayal, of jealousy. The yawning gulf in his chest becomes filled with a new feeling. It pours in like floodwater, hot, ugly rage. Rage gushes up inside him like an urge to vomit. Attila leaps up, pounding at his chest. Growling, gurgling noises erupt from his throat as he begins to tear back and forth through the ruins of the apartment, smashing and tearing everything in his path. He smashes and tears things not yet smashed and torn, and further smashes and tears things that have already been smashed and torn. Today is a day for biting and smashing. He begins pounding on the walls again, knocking down the few remaining pictures. Their frames clatter and crash. More glass scatters across the floor. He grabs the radiator in the hallway, begins to shake it. He winces as he pulls and pulls. The pipe that connects it to the wall whines. There is a shriek and a groan as he rips it free of its moorings. Attila hurls the radiator through the bathroom doorway, the door to which he wrenched off its hinges a few days ago. The radiator bashes the bathroom sink and shatters it. The sink crumbles into chunks of porcelain rubble. Attila Knuckle walks to the front door. He sniffs. He hears Oz coming up the stairs now, with another pair of feet walking in tandem beside or behind him. He has an idea. Quickly, deliberately, he runs through the apartment, clicking off all the lights. The apartment is dark, except for the orange glow from the lights outside filtering through the windows. The torn blinds cast orange tiger stripes of light across the room. A train rumbles by outside and sets the room to shaking. Attila listens to the approaching ascending footsteps. He yawns with his enormous jaws. He waits. Chapter 47. Chloe was still smiling, her body loose, soft and warm in my arms, when the cab dropped us off in front of my building on 125th Street. Then she took a moment to absorb the squalid streetscape. Beside us, two homeless guys in a bus shelter were yelling and shoving each other for some reason as a rat the size of a chihuahua looked on. "Home sweet home," I said, as the Broadway local thundered by above us on the elevated track. "It's not as bad as it looks, I promise."
"It is very,
She spun a finger in the air, searched for a word. "Urban?" I suggested.
"No, no. More, what is the word? Miserable?"
Huffing and puffing after hauling our bags up five flights of stairs, I was turning the key in the lock of my front door when I heard an unusual sound. It was coming from behind the door. It stopped, then started again, loud and rasping, some kind of hiss. I opened the door. I looked out into the darkness of my apartment. I was struck by the smell. Not good. It smelled like shit. I heard the sound more clearly. It was coming from somewhere beyond us through the unlit threshold. I moved in front of Chloe, and the darkness in the doorway seemed to collect together and form into a broad shape. "Attila?" I said. What in the hell? He should have been in his cage. The shadow bulged, and then the weight slammed into my chest like a train. The blow knocked me on my back. "Attila!" I barked. Chloe was somewhere behind me, screaming. I was dazed, on my back in the doorway, my wind knocked out, tailbone smarting like hell, trying to process what was going on. Attila had knocked me over, and now he was tumbling in crazy circles around the apartment. "What the fuck is wrong with you?" I said. I gathered myself to my feet, fumbling for the light switch, glancing behind me for Chloe. How had he gotten out of his cage? He was just scared, I thought, frantically trying to assess the situation. He must have thought I was an intruder or something. I needed to calm him down. I stepped into the apartment and snapped on the light. "Look, Attila," I said. "It's me, Oz. You're safe, kid." The cold white fluorescent light slowly buzzed on, illuminating my apartment. It was a horror show. It looked exactly as though a wild chimp had been let loose in my apartment for a week. The whole place was in shambles. The refrigerator door was open, trickling feeble blue light into the room and humming. The food that had been in it, rotten and scattered across the floor. The cupboard doors were wrenched off their hinges, all the dishes raked out and smashed on the floor, the faucet running in the sink for God knows how long, sticky puddles of dried piss on the linoleum, shit smeared in streaks on the walls. This sight proved to be a preview of what the rest of the apartment looked like. And then, Attila was barreling toward me again from out of the darkened, ruined apartment. He seemed to know exactly who I was, and he was wearing my red hat. "Attila!" I screamed, and he sank his jaws down on my knee. I fought. I kicked. I punched him in the back of his head. He didn't even seem to notice. My fists bounced off his skull like rubber balls. He wasn't the same chimp. Something inside him had snapped. Chloe was screaming. I heard her distantly, as if I were underwater. There was a pan lying overturned on the edge of the kitchen counter, just within arm's reach. It was a hefty black cast-iron skillet that had belonged to my Polish grandmother. I'd eaten pierogi that had been fried in that thing, and that day it may have saved my life. I snatched it up and brought it down on the crown of Attila's head, half strength at first, which did nothing. And then I swung it as though I were Roger Federer hitting a Dunlop cross-court. The gruesome sound of the skillet bonking Attila's skull made me wince. I felt his bite loosen. I hit him with it again, and he let go. He was dazed from the blow. He stumbled back into the corner by the refrigerator. His face was damp with blood. He cowered in the corner, shrieking.
"Oz," said Chloe. "Are you okay?"
Attila turned toward her. His eyes were blank and dangerous. He began to skulk toward us. "Stay away from her!" I heaved the skillet at him. He raised an arm and swatted it off, and the skillet went sailing behind him and smashed through the kitchen window almost as easily as if there hadn't been any glass there. Shards of glass tinkled to the floor. For a moment, I thought he'd snapped out of it. I dropped to the floor on my knees and grimaced in pain. Attila had chewed up my knee badly. "Attila," I said. My hands were palm up, open. I was using my lullaby voice.
"Attila, what's gotten into you? Relax, it's me."
Chloe stood in the open doorway still, as if she were ready to bolt. Attila looked at me. He stood on a pile of crumbled dishes on the kitchen floor. He cocked his head and fixed his gaze on me from under the brim of my red knit hat. Attila's face changed then. For a second, he seemed like himself again. As he looked into my eyes, his expression was an unnerving gaze of unbearable sadness, betrayal, knowing. Then he jumped onto the countertop and out the window, onto the fire escape. He was gone.
Chapter 48. An elderly Hispanic man in rumpled janitor blues is waiting for a bus. He sips a brown bagged can of Tecate and hums half a tune. He's on his way home from work. He nudges up the brim of a sweat-stiffened Yankees cap. Then, a chimpanzee drops off the bottom of the fire escape of the building beside him. The chimp is wearing a red hat. The can of Tecate lands on the sidewalk. Says the chimp. The chimp scrambles past him, an explosion of hairy limbs, feet, fingers. He sniffs, looks around, tears down the sidewalk with a bouncing, loping gait, propelling himself forward with long, powerful arms. The world is suddenly a wild swirl of strange lights and sounds, and a new sense of openness. Blindly knuckle-running down the sidewalk, Attila does not even pause as he bolts into the commotion of 125th Street. It's a circus of honking. Attila streaks in front of a minivan, and the driver lays on the brakes and horn half a moment before the eastbound M104 bus behind it crushes its rear end. There's a crunch of plastic, metal, glass. More honking. Now on the other side of the street, Attila races alongside the long and brightly lit window of a Duane Reade drugstore before he banks the corner around a fried chicken restaurant. He pant hoots at a number one train as it blasts by high overhead on the shaking iron latticework of the elevated tracks. He runs along the sidewalk, past benches and fire hydrants, scrabbling for a place to hide. A group of teenagers are half-heartedly punting around a battered soccer ball on the sidewalk in front of a bodega. A tiny, grizzled Hispanic man sits on a plastic folding chair by the door of the store, smoking a cigarette and watching the kids play soccer. A sleek black car with tinted windows idles on the corner, a rap song blasting from its radio in fuzzy thumps that shake it on its springs. A chimpanzee wearing a red hat rushes headlong through the soccer game. The girls point and shriek. The soccer ball skitters away into the street. A patrol car from the 26th Precinct is just pulling away from the curb in front of a deli on Lenox Avenue when they get the call. "Repeat that dispatch. Who's on the roof of a candy store?" says Sergeant Timothy Perez, a tall, fit, 5-year veteran who was promoted the week before. The radio squeals, static crunches.
A chimpanzee, says the bitch box.
Come again?
Says Officer Jack Murphy at the wheel. The growing crowd on the corner of Broadway and 123rd is spilling into the street when the police arrive on the scene. The lights paint the scene red and blue. Murphy gives half a whoop with the siren and curtly parts the crowd by climbing the cruiser onto the sidewalk. Sergeant Perez rolls down his window and shines his maglight at the red plastic awning of the bodega. Bright eyes flash back at him in the pale ring of light.
Well, I'll be a monkey's uncle, says Murphy.
Okay, so dispatch isn't on shrooms, Perez thinks. What appears to be a chimpanzee is indeed standing on top of the awning, wearing a red hat. Perez and Murphy step out of the car.
Oh, the popo's here, somebody says. What the monkey do, officer? He rob a bank?
One of the kids in front of the store whacks at the bodega's awning with a broom handle.
Come on, Bubbles,
the kid says in a high-pitched voice.
Quit messing. It's me, Michael.
He drops the impression.
Get down here before I beat your ass.
The kids are laughing. It's a circus atmosphere.
Give me that,
Perez says, snatching the broom from the kid. Perez looks up at the chimp. Noticing what looks like blood on the animal's face, he lightly lays his hand on the handle of his Glock. He knows it's not a funny situation. His brother-in-law, a New Jersey state trooper, once told him about an escaped pet chimp in West Orange who had turned some guy's face into a Picasso. These guys can be very dangerous animals, not to be fucked with. Perez puts the radio to his cheek.
We got the monkey over here on 123rd and Broadway. He's perched on the awning over a store. We need to get animal control up here. Someone with a tranquilizer gun or something. We can keep watch in the meantime.
10-4,
says the radio, and Perez clips it to his belt.
What's the matter, McGilla Gorilla? Says Murphy. You want a banana or something?
Perez can't believe it. It looks like talking a chimp off a ledge is going to be the first test of his command. Above the crowd, Attila cowers against the building's bricks, paralyzed with fear and confusion. He scrambles up to escape the crowd of screaming people. And now he can't go up or go down. Adrenaline surges in his nerves as more and more voices cackle and shout from below, and more cars with piercing colored lights arrive. Soon, a large van joins the three police cruisers parked on the street. Two men in crisp tan uniforms step out of the van. Attila peeks out over the edge of the awning, then darts back into the corner against the brick wall. He shrinks into himself, trying to make his body as small as possible. He wants to disappear. Scrunched against the bricks, he finds a bundle of coaxial cables strung along the corner of the 6-story building. He wraps his fingers around it, then his toes. The animal control officers, one of whom is a former horse trainer, aren't city workers but independent contractors hired on a case-by-case basis. The one who's a former trainer chambers a dart into his tranquilizer pistol while his partner unhooks the ladder from the van's roof. Too late. The chimp is climbing.
Hey, hey, yo!
One of the street kids points.
He's going all King Kong up in this shit!
Sergeant Perez and the animal control guy exchange a look and a groan as the chimp scurries up a bundle of cables that runs along the side of the building. The speed with which he zips up there is pretty amazing. Dude is boogieing.
Go, monkey, go!
The kids start chanting. The ape makes it to the top of the 6-story building and disappears over the ledge of the roof. After waiting a respectful moment, Officer Murphy shrugs at his boss and joins in the chanting. Chapter 49. Chloe wanted me to go to the hospital right away. I waved her off. I'd been in enough waiting rooms lately. Still keyed up with adrenaline, I dumped half a bottle of hydrogen peroxide over my knee and taped wads of paper towels to it. Clutching my leg, I hobbled around the apartment surveying the rest of the wreckage. It was as if everything I owned had been fed through a wood chipper. There was hardly an object in the apartment that Attila hadn't found a way of smashing, to say nothing of the suffocating, nauseating stench of rotten food combined with the piss and shit spattered everywhere. I figured I shouldn't count on getting my deposit back. I had known that before long Attila would become unmanageable, and I'd have to find a more suitable home for him, but he was only 5. Chimps generally don't get too unruly until they're a bit older. I couldn't help but wonder if what I was looking at here showed rage, a personal anger toward me. What had made Attila do this? Separation anxiety? And how had he escaped from his cage? With our bags still piled in the hallway outside the door, Chloe stepped gingerly amid the wreckage, afraid to touch anything.
Oz, I'm so sorry, she said.
Maybe it was Chloe's presence that had set him off. Chimps are fiercely territorial and have often been observed to kill over boundary disputes. Had Attila perceived Chloe as some sort of territorial threat? On the other hand, he'd clearly taken a lot of time to do this much damage to the apartment. I was walking past the doorway of the back bedroom when I smelled something especially foul. Even worse than the potpourri of rotten food and fecal matter that the rest of the apartment reeked of. In the bedroom doorway, I smelled something so concentratedly dense, so horrific, that I was afraid to turn on the light. But I did turn on the light. I stood there for a moment, stock still, breathing heavily.
What is it, Oz?
Chloe called from behind me in the hallway. It wasn't just that the room was a wreck. It wasn't just that the stripped mattress was torn to tattered fluff and sodden with urine, though there was that. I could feel my heartbeat hammering in my ears as my eyes scanned the room. There was blood on the walls, in thin streaks and freckles, in wide, heavy smears. Handprints. Huge, long handprints. Chimp handprints. There was one right there beside the switch plate, which also had blood on it. Four very long, thick fingers and a small, stubby hook of a thumb. I looked up. There was dried blood misted on the light fixture in the ceiling. It gave the room a slightly pinkish cast. All this blood had been there for days. It was dry and dark, the color of brown rust. With my eyes, I followed the blood smears to the far corner of the room.
What?
Chloe said in the hallway. There was something on the floor in the corner of the room opposite me, between the bed and the wall. The streaks of blood led there, just as all roads led to Rome. I could feel Chloe behind me. Stay there, I said. Don't come in. I covered my face with the collar of my shirt and I stepped farther into the room. I tasted bitterness in the back of my mouth. Bile was rising in my throat. It was a human body. Most of one, anyway. It was a decomposing and what looked like a partially eaten human body. I couldn't identify it by the face, because the face was gone. As were the feet and hands. But there was long red hair. Red Irish girl's hair. And the body was wearing turquoise hospital scrubs. A rectangular plastic card was clipped to the breast pocket of the blood-stiffened shirt. I unclipped it and looked at it. Under dirt-brown streaks of dried blood, there was Natalie's deer-in-the-headlights mugshot on her hospital ID badge. Natalie Marie Shaw, it said beneath the picture. I hardly noticed Chloe as I brushed past her in the hallway. I'd made it to the front door when Chloe grabbed my arm.
What is it? Tell me, Oz, please. What's in there?
I babbled. My girlfriend. She balked, scrunched her face up. Her face showed confusion, with the possibility of anger in it.
I thought she was your ex-girlfriend.
She is now. We called the police from Mrs. Mullen's apartment. Mrs. Mullen, my next-door neighbor, a sweet little Irish lady who was so old she'd probably come over in the potato famine. I wasn't terribly shocked when Mrs. Mullen said she hadn't heard anything in the last week. The lady was deaf as a stone. She didn't even know I lived with a chimp. The first cops to arrive were already aware of Attila. They told me he had been spotted on the street, but that he was still on the loose. Something about hiding on the roof of a bodega. What now? What do I do with my life? My home was destroyed. If I hadn't zipped off to Africa and asked Natalie to take care of Attila, she would still be alive. My fault. If I didn't have a fucking chimp in my apartment, she would still be alive. Also my fault. She was a saint. Even after breaking up with me, she'd still come over to check on Attila. And he had killed her. I went further and further back down the chain of decisions I'd made, thinking about what I could have done differently. A lot. Regret sucked at my heart like a leech. Chloe sat beside me and held my hand as I sat in the stairwell, while police radios squawked and crackled in my apartment, and all down the hallway neighbors had come out to stare. What now? What indeed? And the nightmare wasn't over. Not even close. Book 4. The Natives Are Restless. Chapter 50. 5 years later. When I felt the train slow, my eyes fluttered, bringing me out of an impromptu nap. Outside the window of the Acela, I could see we weren't in D.C. yet. We were going through a seemingly abandoned industrial town in South Jersey, or maybe Northern Maryland. These decaying towns all looked depressingly the same. Windowless brick factories, deserted, rusting bridges. A main street lined with plywood, boarded windows, and overgrown with weeds. Going back to nature, slowly. Turns out an apocalypse actually comes on pretty slowly. Not fire and brimstone, but rust and dandelions. Not a bang, but a whimper. Perhaps it was due to the continuing economic downturn, but rumors abounded on the internet. People were dying in these in-between places. No one knew why. I had my theories. Gazing out at the orphaned town, I thought of that line from Yeats. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. For a moment, I stared blankly at my reflection in the black screen of the sleeping laptop that was open on the tray table in front of me. You could have packed for a long weekend in the bags under my eyes. So much to do and so little goddamn time to do it. For the last 5 years, I've been working nonstop with my friends at Columbia to try to get a handle on HAC. A lot of the work consisted of collecting the corpses of affected animals and performing autopsies on them. We'd seen a lot of specimens. Too many. Tigers from India, Russian bears, beavers, wolverines, even ground squirrels. The unusually aggressive behavior had spread to so many mammal species we were starting to lose count. It wasn't rabies. As far as we could tell from the specimens we'd studied, it didn't seem like a virus. We had noticed something interesting, though. The brains of the affected animals were a little heavier than normal. Not only that, but they were heavier by the same amount, about 1.3%. The increase in brain matter seemed to be concentrated mostly in the amygdala, the part of the mammalian brain generally thought to be responsible for memory and learning. The finding was unusual enough to finally get the government on board. For the last year, we'd gotten decent funding and had been working with a liaison from the Department of Health and Human Services. So the good news now was that we had provided the world with proof that something was causing abnormal mutations in mammalian amygdalae that were triggering this aberrantly aggressive behavior. The bad news was that we didn't have a clue what it was. There were other questions. Why were some animals affected and not others? And why were humans entirely unaffected by these mutations? Were there other symptoms associated with the mutations? Yes, and they varied from one species to another. In some species, lions, for instance, the mutations seemed to affect only male animals. Not so in other species. There had been an ugly episode of bizarrely psychotic behavior among a group of female elephants in Thailand. Every hunch we got about every question opened up a fresh jar of more questions. Questions that had been answered sprouted more questions, like the heads of the hydra. Cut off one and two grow back in its place. I stared out at the wasteland that America was becoming, rusting under the hard, pitiless summer sky. Chapter 51. And there was more bad news that morning. Special, just for me. I had to interrupt my research in order to head down to D.C. to do my Chicken Little dance at another time suck of a congressional hearing. For all the scientific evidence we were amassing, and in spite of the exponential increases in animal attacks, which were irrefutable, many people, both in the government and in the citizenry our elected officials are supposedly beholden to, were still refusing to accept that anything out of the ordinary was happening. I wasn't the only voice screaming in the wilderness anymore, but still, not everyone had heard the call. In those first few years, it was a long uphill battle to get people to recognize what was happening. I had frequently been at loggerheads in the op-ed pages with Harvey Saltonstall. Yes, the Harvey Saltonstall, evolutionary biologist, popular science writer, holder of the Henry Wentworth Wallace Chair at Harvard. I had a couple of public debates with him, too. Harvey and I had shared a few split screens on the news shows. He was my most prominent public critic, and his opposition to HAC must have delayed public acceptance of it by years. It drove me nuts debating him. He had the academic cred, the name, the CV, and who the hell was I? I looked like your office's IT guy standing next to that stately, handsome man, twiggy in his tweeds, with his pipe-smoky baritone, his Boston Brahmin accent, and that obnoxious tick of swiping back his silver hair. Twit. I rubbed circles on my throbbing temples with my thumbs, my gathering headache coming at me in fuzzy radio waves of pain, and was more astonished than alarmed when a guy I didn't know came in and sat down across from me. He looked like an ex-husband of Britney Spears. Skinny arms, blue with bad tats. Houndstooth Sinatra hat, a goatee that looked drawn on. A small part of me wondered if I was still asleep. "Can I help you?" I said.
"You Jackson Oz?"
I might have rolled my eyes. "Here we go." So then, I'd written a book about HAC, which had become a controversial bestseller. On the one hand, it was the best thing I'd done yet to spread the word about HAC. It led to appearances on the major media outlets, where I tried to warn people about the growing danger and the increasingly dire need for immediate, coordinated action. On the other hand, I was sort of famous, or rather, infamous. Pet owners didn't like me much. Dog people especially despised my message, now even more so since we'd gotten Congress and the President to consider a national quarantine. "Actually, no," I said. "But I get that all the time." The man was unfazed.
"Why you gotta hate on dogs, yo? Why you gotta be getting people all crazy and shit? To sell your stupid-ass books? My Roddy ain't evil. She's a sweetheart."
"Everything okay here?"
said a behemoth of a black man in a tailored pinstripe suit who had just materialized in the doorway beside K-Fed.
"We having a conversation here," the guy said with righteous indignation. "A private conversation."
"Not anymore,"
said my sometime bodyguard, FBI Special Agent Nemo Cade. He flashed a winning smile and a badge.
"Would you like to find your seat, or do you need some help?"
Nemo shouldered the dipshit out of the train car, and I let out a long breath of relief. Working with the government has its perks. This sort of thing happened a lot. My email inbox was so full of death threats that these days I just deleted them without being curious enough to open them.
"You bring out the best and brightest, don't you, Oz?"
Nemo said when the guy was gone. "It's my sparkling personality," I said. "Where is everyone?" Chloe appeared in the doorway of the train car. The best thing about the last 5 years, five unrewarding years of slaving away in the lab, constant traveling, constant frustration, was having Chloe by my side. She'd been working as hard as I was, harder, actually. And somehow, instead of sporting my burned, fused cheek, she was her same self, with silky skin and owlish eyes, her body willowy and elegant as a stroke of calligraphy. Then there was a noisy porcine squeal, and something giggly and sticky shot through the open doorway, scrambled onto the seat, and landed in my lap.
"Egads, a monster!"
I said in my 1930s radio drama voice, as our three-year-old son, Eli, climbed me as though he were Sir Edmund Hillary and I were Everest. I put him in a mock headlock and kissed him on top of his fuzzy blonde head. Eli wasn't only a rambunctious kid who loved wrestling and snapping together Lego guns. He was smart, as a whip. At 18 months, he could write words on the fridge with magnet letters. And he was bilingual in English and French. Chloe and I had gotten married in a quickie job in the city clerk's office the day after she found out she was pregnant. Then we'd held a ceremony for friends and family a couple months later. Eli was born 8 weeks prematurely and had to be put in the NICU. We were afraid he might not make it. But a week later, he bounced back, started getting bigger and healthier. Watching him hop up next to Chloe in the seat across from me and open his favorite book, The Jungle Book, my depression was replaced with a rejuvenated sense of determination. The hell with Yates, I thought. The center would hold. It would have to. For my wife and son, I'd make it hold or die trying. Chapter 52. Traffic was stopped dead on the way to the Capitol from Union Station. In the back seat of the sleek black government sedan, Eli fidgeted in my lap, gnawing like a gremlin on a fruit leather he had gotten at Trader Joe's. He was getting cranky. Chloe was already cranky because they didn't have the car seat for Eli that they said they would. The afternoon sun sparkled on the sea of chrome and glass and glowered like a fat yellow bully above us, a problem that the car's anemic AC alleviated exactly not at all. I was getting pretty cranky myself. Another worthless hearing? What's the use? Nothing ever happened at these kangaroo courts but a jamboree of choreographed histrionics. Worst of all, Senator Charlie Chargaff, my avowed arch-enemy, was going to be on the inquiry panel today. I couldn't wait to get grilled by a hair-plug good old boy with a spray-on tan who was going to try to ride his demonization of me into the White House. When at long last we rounded a corner, I could see the reason for the clogged traffic. A block from the Capitol complex, a smattering of young people in black hoodies and black masks were squaring off against riot cops. Several of the protesters were waving black flags with a Circle A anarchy symbol sprayed on them in cracked white paint. Billowing plumes of pink smoke sprayed up around them. Car horns honked all around us like the bleating of bored sheep.
"What are these fools protesting now?"
Chloe said, watching from the corner of her eye as Eli whacked a Batman action figure against the seat, making blow-up noises with his cheeks.
"They already have what they want. Anarchy is here."
The driver peeled off into a U-turn and brought us around the back of the Capitol building. I felt the tickling buzz of my phone vibrating in the inner lining of my suit jacket. The caller ID said, U.S. government.
"Who is it?"
Chloe said. "Uncle Sam," I said.
"Mr. Oz?" said a resonant voice.
"Speaking?"
"Are you at the hearing yet?"
"Bad traffic on my way. Who is this?"
"This is Stanley Marshall, the president's chief of staff. Something's come up, a matter of national security. We need your help on it. Take a detour and come for a meeting."
"Now? I'm scheduled to speak in half an hour."
"I understand that, Mr. Oz. The president would like to speak to you instead. This is more pressing. Put one of the agents on the phone. I can give him directions."
I lurched into the front seat and handed Nemo my phone.
"What was that?"
Chloe said as we pulled another U-turn. Eli dropped his Batman figure on the car floor as we turned.
"Mommy, get Batman!"
"I don't know," I half-whispered. "I guess we're going to meet the president." 10 minutes later, the car was pulling into a municipal parking garage in DuPont Circle. Seemed fishy. I leaned up front. "Are we meeting Deep Throat?" I said. "I thought we were going to the White House." Nemo looked back at me and shrugged.
"They told us to come here," he said,
as we wheeled onto the garage's ramp. We slowly circled up to the roof. I was confused. It was deserted.
"What is this?"
Chloe said.
"There's no one here."
"Damn," I said.
"Mommy,"
said Eli.
"Get Batman."
"What?"
said Chloe, ignoring him. This must have been a ploy. Senator Chargaff. He must have found my number and had someone call pretending to be the chief of staff so I wouldn't show up to the hearing. Make me look like a flake, bastard. I tried calling the number that had just called me. I was listening to the phone ring, unanswered, when we heard a low, chopping mumble, like an industrial fan heard through a pillow. A plastic bag drifting along the concrete wall beyond the windshield fluttered and took flight, graceful as a bird, blown across the cityscape of D.C. Then we heard the deafening suck-and-throb tattoo of a landing helicopter, cottoning the air like a migraine in the head of God. The whirly bird that landed 5 empty spots to the left of the sedan was a massive Black Hawk with military markings. An army colonel in mirrored aviators and a jacket as decorated as a Christmas tree hopped out of it and jog-walked toward the car.
"Daddy!"
Eli yelled in my ear.
"What?"
I yelled above the throbbing din.
"Get Batman!"
Chapter 53. And we'd been worried about no car seat for Eli in the car. Strapped into the wailing, shuddering army helicopter a few minutes later, We pushed off the parking garage roof and swung low as a sweet chariot over downtown Washington. We picked up altitude, and before long it was no longer concrete and highways, but rolling, jewel-green Virginia swampland that rushed by beneath us. I looked over at Eli, who was strapped in on Chloe's lap, clutching his Batman, eyes big as frisbees, in awe. We banked hard and thundered due north for 20 minutes or so, and then began descending again. An office park of stark glass buildings emerged from the forest. From the vantage point of a few thousand feet above, they looked like blocks of ice melting on the grass. We dove toward the central building. I thought we were going to land on the red H of the helipad on the ground next to it, but instead, the pilot guided us onto the flat roof of the building.
"Thanks, Colonel,"
yelled a silver-haired man in a Navy windbreaker who was waiting for us on the roof as we disembarked.
"I'll take it from here."
The colonel flicked a salute at him, and the chopper picked up behind us and rose skyward. I noticed the letters NSA on the electronic badge clipped to the pocket of his crisp white dress shirt as he led me, Chloe, Eli, and Nemo across the sun-baked asphalt of the roof toward a door. The National Security Agency, the department that does worldwide electronic surveillance for all the intelligence services, so cloak and dagger that some people call it no such agency.
"Section Chief Mike Leahy," the man said, shaking my hand as we entered the building. "Thanks for agreeing to come."
He led us out of a stairwell into a long, blinding white corridor.
"Sorry for all the drama, but when," he glanced at Eli, "the you-know-what hits the fan, things tend to work pretty fast around here."
We turned a corner and entered a semicircular room that had rows of seats and a podium in front. It reminded me of a college lecture hall. Behind the podium was a shiny, sleek television screen the size of a billboard. A side door opened, and a middle-aged black man entered the room. Leahy was in business attire, but this guy wore a black polo shirt with black jeans and Chuck Taylors that squeaked like balloon animals on the shiny white floor. The gold Rolex at his wrist added a splash of bling to the ensemble.
"Are you the president?"
Eli said, gazing up at him.
"No, I'm not," the man said.
"Actually," Leahy said, smiling stiffly, "the president has been detained. This is Conrad Marlowe from the Defense Department."
"Don't jerk their chains, Mike," Marlowe said. His teeth could have been mahjong tiles, and his voice was like a velvet cello. "Mr. Oz here is smarter than that. He saw this coming back in 2012. Hell, back in 2011, 2010. The president's not coming. They say that to get you on the bird. And technically, I'm not from the Defense Department. I work for a think tank. War games. That kind of happy crap. They think I can solve this Rubik's Cube, but I'm having my doubts."
"But we really do need your help, Mr. Oz," said Leahy. Now standing in the doorway was a severe-looking sparrow of a woman with threaded brows and hair yanked back as tight as a figure skater's. She clicked her knuckles twice on the open door. Leahy cleared his throat.
"This is Jan, my assistant," he said. "Would it be all right if she brought Eli across the hall to have some ice cream and play computer games while we talk shop?"
"Heck, if he doesn't want to go, I'm down,"
Marlowe said, glancing at Jen, a speck of fire hissing in his eye.
"Can I go, Mommy? No ice cream without the magic world, okay? Please?"
Eli beamed, bright as a headlight, as Jen herded him out the door. "Hard to find a sitter on short notice," I told Leahy.
"Okay,"
Chloe said after they were gone.
"Let's cut to the chase, yes? What is this? Why are we here? What's happened?"
"It's here, Mrs. Oz," Leahy said.
"What's here?" I said.
"HAC has arrived in the United States like gangbusters," said Marlowe. "The animals are on the warpath. It's spreading. A pandemic.
We're calling the unfortunate new environment ZOO, Leahy said, spelling out the word. "Those letters stand for something, but fuck if I can remember what." Marlowe snickered.
"And we're just one of the animals."
Chapter 54. Annapolis, Maryland. Dr. Charles Groh lets the hiss and crackle rise to a frenzy, and then, sensing their undersides beginning to burn, reaches a fork into the cast-iron pan and overturns the slices of bacon one by one. The bacon strips tremble and buckle,
spitting a mist of fat flecks and smoke above the pan. Behind him, sprawled on the pattern floor of Mexican Talavera tiles, his chocolate lab, Charlie II, whines pitifully and drums his tail against the side of the kitchen island. His whining erupts into a yelp.
"Patience, Charlie, patience," Gros says, waving his fork in the air like a maestro. "With the important things in life, it's all about the timing, and bacon is a very important thing."
After draping the bacon on a paper towel, Gros hobbles to the sink with his cane and washes his hand. The male gorilla who had attacked him in his primatology lab at Johns Hopkins 3 years ago took his left hand, as well as his nose, his lips, his right eye, left ear, and his right leg from the knee down. Gros uses a prosthetic hand and leg. The incident had actually been a perverse godsend in a cosmic sense. Back then, everything had been put on the back burner but his career. He was tenured, secure in his career, with a CV thick as a phone book. He had written academic books and several popular books on gorillas and had been awarded a genius grant from the MacArthur Foundation. He was the toast of intellectual circles. But as his career floated higher and higher into the ether, he had been spending less and less time with his wife, Adriana, and his son, Christopher Robin. He was growing distant from his family, and Christopher was growing up without him. He was even neglecting his teaching, sloughing off most of his classes on TAs. For all its pain and horror, the mauling and his long, grueling recovery had saved him, in a way. It brought him back down to earth. Yes, he now wears sunglasses in public, and his potential career as a foot model is shot, but he can still teach. Although certain positions are off the table, he can still make love to his wife. He can still fry bacon. All things considered, Gros thinks, lifting a steaming mug of coffee to his surgically reconstructed lips, he is a relatively lucky man. Gros folds a strip of bacon into his mouth and switches on the radio beside the sink. The needle zeroed in on some nattering morning talk show, and he paws around the dial until he lands on some classical music. Verdi. That's better. He hears the clink of crockery against the marble counter of the kitchen island and turns. His 12-year-old son mumbles a good morning as he tilts a box of Lucky Charms into a cereal bowl. He's a handsome kid, currently brown as a nut from hours of outdoor play at his summer day camp.
"Hey, kiddo," Gros says. "Cease and desist with the charms. I made us bacon."
"Bacon and what?"
says Chris, turning on the MLB network on the kitchen TV. He mutes it, letting his dad's Verdi score the recap of the Braves losing to the Orioles the night before.
"Bacon and bacon so far," Gros says, opening the fridge. "How about an egg?"
"Can I have bacon with Lucky Charms?"
says his son, staring at the screen.
"I don't know. Would your mother let you do that?"
Adriana is in Baltimore for a few days with her elderly mother, who just had her gallbladder removed.
"Are you nuts? Hell no," Chris says.
Gros smiles as he brings over the steaming pieces of swine.
"Then have at it, boy," he says. "She'll be home soon."
Gros makes his way across the floor between the kitchen and the front door when he hears a truck pull up outside. He glances out the window and sees that it's a lawn doctor truck in front of the neighbor's place across the street. A couple of childless yuppie lobbyists who pull down some long green, apparently, judging from their matching beamers. They certainly aren't landscapers. Crabgrass and brown spots model their sickly lawn like mange, hence the lawn doctor truck. When he turns from the window, Charlie II is looking out the open front door, panting as he spies with him on the neighbors through the glass of the storm door. Gros galumps back toward the kitchen on his cane, patting the dog on top of his sleek, brown, dopey head. A flurry of shiny red cartoon hearts is floating out of Charlie II's expression.
"Okay," Gros
says, scooping up his keys with a jingle from the kitchen counter.
"I'm off to work. You're on your own for another hour, Chris. Mom left Nana's already, and we'll be here to take you to camp. Love you."
"Dad, wait. I almost forgot,"
Chris says. Gros watches his son ransack the backpack dangling from a hook on the wall by the front door. He fishes something from the bag and hands it to him, what looks like a red and white plastic necklace.
"It's a lanyard. I made it at camp yesterday," says Chris. "I thought it could hold your sunglasses, you know, like around your neck, when you're working or something. I made it red and white for the gnats."
Gros looks at it, then at his son, his one eye threatening to fog up.
Hey, thanks, kiddo, Gro says. It's awesome. Are the Nats playing tonight?
At home, versus the Diamondbacks. 7 tonight. Strasburg starting.
You want to go? Gro says.
What? To the stadium? Heck yeah,
says Chris, slapping him a high five.
Lucky man, Gro thinks again, as he pats his son on the shoulder, and then steps into the garage. Chapter 55.
Hey, Charlie, want some bacon?
Chris says to Charlie the Second when his dad is gone.
Hear that, boy? The Nats game. Steven Strasburg throws like 100 miles an hour.
He heads back into the kitchen. The dog's claws click on the floor tiles behind him. No one in the family loves Charlie the Second more than Chris. They've practically grown up together, having been pups at the same time. The family has moved 3 times following Charles's new jobs, and each time, Charlie the Second was Chris's best friend until he managed to make human friends. Chris remembers how hard it was to make the dog stay home when he went off to play with his friends. Charlie the Second would whine in sadness, his eyes forlornly watching Chris from the window as he left the house. And if Chris looked back, he might not be able to leave. To not be with Chris seems to be the hardest thing for the dog to do. They are as close as brothers. Chris kills the Verdi on the radio, turns up the volume on the TV, and zaps through the channels with one hand, searching for ESPN. With the other hand, he picks up a slice of bacon from the grease-dampened paper towel and offers it to Charlie the Second under the counter. A hot shock of pain in his hand, Chris drops the remote.
Hey!
He yanks back his hand and looks at it. Charlie bit him. There are puncture marks in his hand.
Ow! What the fuck? What'd you do that for?
Chris looks agape at Charlie the Second, standing beside him in the kitchen. The piece of bacon lies untouched on the floor tiles. Something is not right. There is some weird look in the dog's eyes, some knowing, almost angry glaze in them that Chris has never seen before. Charlie begins to growl. His jowls flabber against his teeth, spit percolating deep in his throat. The 80-pound Labrador crouches, coiling back, the fur bristling high and stiff as steel wool on the back of his neck. He is growling, sounding like a guard dog, his teeth bared, a gloopy white thread yo-yoing from his lower lip in a pool of saliva.
What in the hell? What's wrong, boy? Stop it! It's me! What's wrong with you?
It looks like one of his eyes is messed up. Charlie's head keeps jerking to one side, as though he were a boxer shaking off a punch. Something is wrong. Charlie curls in on his hind legs and lets loose with a string of the loudest, most threatening barks Chris has ever heard him make. He sounds like a junkyard dog warning off intruders, not the family pet he's known more than half his life. Charlie is in a rage, lungs heaving up quick, loud, guttural barks that sound like, "Rrr, rrr." That's it. Chris gets scared. He panics. He tumbles from his chair and starts running. He feels Charlie's hot breath on the backs of his knees, hears jaws snapping behind him. The closest door is the hallway pantry. Chris dashes inside and slams the door, and feels the whump and rattle of Charlie throwing his weight against it. He leans with his back against the pantry door, holding it shut. On the other side of it, Charlie smashes his body into the door, the thing shuddering on its hinges under the impact. Charlie scrabbles his toenails at the door, clawing and barking, heaves himself into it in manic thumps, seemingly wanting to rip him to ribbons. In all the years they have owned the dog, he's never sounded like a wild animal. He's gone crazy, Chris thinks. He saw it in his eyes. The dog is off his rocker. He no longer seems like Charlie the Second. He is something else, another dog entirely, a bad dog. He feels himself beginning to cry. In the hallway, he can hear the dog skulking in circles.